Okay, so Dave Morrison is talking about Kalam Yao singularity.
Okay. So this is actually the first of what is likely to be a series of talks, although there will be gaps in the series, temporal gaps in the series. Like the next one will probably be in April. But April's not so far away, because we have seminars scheduled for most other days between now and April. So I want to talk about Kalam Yao singularities, and basically, I want to try to talk about the mathematics underlying Kalam Yao singularities as well as the places that get used in application to string theory. So the basic point is that Kalam Yao manifolds, I'll remind you of the definition in a minute, are used in various ways in string compactification, constructing models of string theory which make sense in lower dimension than the 10 dimensions that string theory normally exists in, or models of M theory, I should say string or M compactifications, models of M theory which live in lower dimensions. And these Kalam Yao manifolds depend on parameters, and those parameters show up in the data for compactification. But there are some limits of the parameters. So if you let these parameters, I don't know, let me call them A1 to AK, if you let the A's approach certain limiting values, then the limit is not a Kalam Yao anymore. Nevertheless, there are a number of cases where one has reason to believe that the limiting object, whatever it means, still makes sense in this application to string compactification. So I want to try to describe what kinds of limits we see, what the mathematical structure is near those limits, what the physical structure is near those limits, and what kinds of differences there may be between the ultimate complete physical theory and the sort of geometric approximation to that theory given by the string compactification. So it's a broad subject or a collection of subjects, it's sort of hard to figure out where to start in talking about it. So I decided today to start with the parameter spaces themselves. And sort of indicate what the parameter spaces are and why we get limits within those parameter spaces where the limiting object is not a Kalam Yao manifold anymore. But before I do that systematically, I want to give some examples. So the problem with starting with examples is I haven't given the definitions yet, but actually there are several problems with the definitions. I mean, what I've just described to you is the motivation for, at least from the point of view of this application, for which kinds of Kalam Yao singularities we would like to look at. Having said that, it turns out that this does not unambiguously specify what kinds of singularities we should be studying. So the examples can help, maybe, in figuring out what the right class of singularities is to be looking at. Okay, so what are my examples? The first example is a kind of easy one. I take, I should have told you what a Kalam Yao manifold was, I guess. I wanted to do that first. So for me, a Kalam Yao manifold means a compact Riemannian manifold since it's Riemannian, I specified a metric, and the metric has holonomy SUN. So it should be a manifold of real dimension 2n, and the holonomy should be SUN. So holonomies really are always subgroups of the, orthogonal group in that dimension, so I'm talking about this specific subgroup. And it's known that when n is at least 3, then there is a unique complex structure which is compatible with the metric. The metric is Kähler in that complex structure. And the set of equivalence classes, or the set of metrics, I should say, breaks locally into a product of the set of complex structures on the manifold and the set of Kähler metrics. So I refer to this as a local product. Even that's slightly not true. You'll see in a minute. I'll explain in a few minutes why there's some difficulty with that as a statement about products.
We say that the second factor depends on the complex structure in that energy.
So this set of Kähler metrics is some subset. Since n is at least 3, is some subset of the second cohomology with real coefficients in a natural way. So there are cohomology classes for these Kähler metrics. And what's true is that you could take a trivial H2XR bundle over the space of complex structures, but then within that you might imagine that there was some variation about the Kähler cone. That variation about the Kähler cone, so it's possible at special values of the complex structure for the Kähler cone to jump. And that's actually the reason that I can't quite say it's a product. If I sort of take into account appropriate automorphisms, which I'll describe in a second, then it looks a little more like a product, but then it's only local, because the automorphisms might have mixed up the bundle structure a little bit. So, and of course, whatever a Calabi-Yau singularity is, I'm going to have to relax that word manifold. And the parameter spaces that I was discussing a few minutes ago are exactly these parameter spaces which talk about the complex structures and Kähler metrics on the Calabi-Yau manifold. Now, the case n equal 2, which is interesting for constructing examples, is a little bit different. So the complex structure is not unique. You don't get this product structure. So just for now, I'll say n equals 2 is different. But it's still an important guide to many aspects of the theory, so I'll talk about that case as well. And what people often do in sort of focusing attention on the singularities is to actually just study somehow a neighborhood of the singular point rather than the entire compact manifold, and maybe separate the questions into sort of local questions about the structure of the singularity itself, and then a more global question about which of those singularities actually occur on global compact Calabi-Yau manifolds, well, or degenerate ones where we've taken some limit in the parameter space. Okay, so I want to try to give some examples of things that get called Calabi-Yau singularities. And my first example is going to be Cn mod Zm, where m divides n, and the action is going to take complex coordinates. The action of a generator of the cyclic group is going to take complex coordinates x1 to xn to e to the 2 pi I over m x1 up through e to the 2 pi I over m xn. Okay? So having specified that m divides n tells me that this holomorphic form of top degree is invariant. Of course, you can do more examples. You can do Cn mod various groups, cyclic or even bigger groups than cyclic ones. The key thing for what I'm going to say is that there's an isolated singularity. Yes?
You said compact, so there's a little bit of an issue.
Yeah, these aren't compact. Sorry. So let me just. I also said manifold, right? So this.
The reason objecting is that sometimes in non-compact cases you have things that go wrong that don't go wrong in compact setups.
Absolutely. So we're going to take limits, and our limits are going to be some kind of compact objects with singularities, okay? I'm not going to say what that means at the moment, but compact. But they're going to have topology, and they're going to be compact in that topology. As I just said in words a minute ago, I can separate the study of Calabi-Yau singularities into sort of two parts. One part being what's the local structure of the singularity, and the other part being which of these local singularities fit into compact objects.
Yeah, that's exactly where things can go wrong sometimes.
Of course. So, to take a simple example, there's this nice ADE classification of singularities in dimension 2, right? And we know exactly what the singularities are, but it happens that, so they're AN, DN, sorry, N is the dimension today. They're AK, DK, and E67, and E8, but it turns out that K is at most 19 if you're going to be able to put it on a K3 manifold. But from the point of view of studying the structure of the singularity, 19 plays no role whatsoever. So I'm separating those two kinds of issues, and I completely agree with you that there are going to be a number of aspects of the Calabi-Yau space which this kind of example doesn't capture, but I want to give a few examples of the local structure. So I want to point out specific cases of this, n equals 2, that's the familiar C2 mod Z2. It's the first of what I just alluded to, the rational double point singularities. It has a nice property that if you look at the group action, which is just -1 in the space, you can write down local invariants for that group action in the form of the quadratic expressions in the variables. The quadratic monomials in the variables are all invariant. And if I were to call those u, v, and w, then there's a local equation, uw minus v squared equals 0. So I can regard this singularity from one perspective as being this kind of quotient singularity, from another perspective as being defined by a single equation in three complex variables. And this actually leads to two different important points of view about singularities. Maybe I didn't really need to give the quotient description to give this this form of the description of the singularity shows you how it might arise as a limit of complex structures. Namely, I could take a deformed equation. This is called a deformation of the singularity. I could take a defining polynomial like the one I have and deform it somehow, in this case just by putting in an epsilon. And that would give me, I can sort of draw a picture. When epsilon equals 0, there's a singularity. When epsilon is non-zero, it became non-singular. That gives me some kind of family of complex structures which has, in the limit, when epsilon goes to 0, this kind of behavior. There's something else you can do to this singularity, which I'll get to in a minute. So a second case of this, n equals m equals 3. So that's the singularity C3 mod Z3. Well, I could try to do the same sort of thing, but then I'm going to get kind of a mess. So I can take all of the cubic polynomials in three variables, and then I could try to write down the relations among them. So this is U1 up through U10, and I could try to write down all the relations. So now it's not simple. I mean, what was nice about this case was that I could write down a single polynomial relation, which generated all the possible polynomial relations among group invariants, and I could describe the variety in that way. But here the relations are very complicated, and there's a theorem, which is due to Schlesinger from a long time ago, the 1970s or maybe even 60s, which says that if you have Cn mod gamma with an isolated singularity, and n is at least 3, then there are no complex structure deformations. So it's fun to play with in this easiest of all examples of this kind, because you can write down explicitly what all the polynomials are, and you can start to write relations, right? I mean, the relations are things like, you know, x1 cubed, x3 cubed would be x1 squared x3, and then x1 x3 squared. So you get lots and lots of relations. And then your job is, and by the way, then there are relations among the relations, which are known as syzygies, and then relations among the relations among the relations, and I think you stop at that point. And then your job is to kind of perturb that whole nice algebraic structure in a way that keeps the dimension of the space of solutions the same, and Schlesinger's theorem shows that that's actually never possible in this context. So although you might have thought that deformation was, this was one of the main reasons that it was invariant, and I forgot to say that that holonomy condition, SUN, that really said that there had to be a holomorphic n-form, a holomorphic form of top degree, and so that's the form of the condition that I'm keeping in this class of examples. In low dimensions, you can understand them in terms of deformation, but once you get to higher dimension, deformation doesn't do it. There's another thing you can do, however, which is to blow up the singularity. So what does it mean to blow up the singularity? Well, it means I try to find a space X mapping to my singular space with the property that pi restricted to pi, to X minus the inverse image of 0 is an isomorphism. So away from the singular point, I have an isomorphism. And then maybe this map pi should be proper, something like that, so that I know for sure that if I take limit points down here, I get some kind of limit up there. And you could do that in each of these cases. And what you find is that X looks like the total space of the line bundle O of minus M over CP N minus 1. So if you do more complicated group actions, then although you can do this resolution of singularities, it's much more complicated than the one I just gave, which is why I restricted to this class of examples. So in this case, I would simply get in this case here, I would get O of minus 3 over CP2. The total space of that line bundle, it looks like some kind of cone over CP2, and exactly how the complex cone over CP2, and exactly how the singular point looks like a complex cone over CP2. When you resolve it, you get the total space of this line bundle over CP2. So the directions going away from the origin become the directions along the fibers of that complex line bundle. So here's a case where I can both blow up and, so in this case I can both blow up and deform. So here I would have gotten O of minus 2 over CP1. I can describe it either way. And as I'll explain in a few minutes, this blowing up process is really like, or rather, the inverse of this blowing up process is really like taking an appropriate limit in the Kähler parameters, like this one was taking an appropriate limit in the complex structure parameters. So in this example, I can blow up okay, but I can't deform. However, if I look at n equal 4, m equal 2, then the blow up is the total space of O minus 2 over CP3. And this has no non-vanishing holomorphic 4 form. So these two examples had the nice case that there was a non-vanishing holomorphic 3 form in this case, and 2 form in the other case. So it really looked like a piece of a Calabi-Yau space. Here it does not look like a piece of a Calabi-Yau space. And in fact, there's a theorem that for this example, for C4 mod Z2, well, Schlesinger's theorem tells you that there's no deformation. This has no blow-up with no smooth blow-up, I should say, with a non-vanishing holomorphic 4 form. So, should I call it a Calabi-Yau singularity or not? Well, pardon?
Yes.
Yes, I should. Yes, and I will explain why I'm supposed to call it a Calabi-Yau singularity. So, I suggested that we should study Calabi-Yau singularities by limits in the parameter space, but, in fact, there's another place where a particular class of singularities shows up in string theory applications, and that is that string theorists early on, Dixon, Harvey, Vafa, and Witten in particular, in the early days of string theory, realized that you could use certain kinds of singular spaces for string propagation equally well as using manifolds, so long as that singular space had the global form of a quotient by a finite group. So, and the singularities don't have to be isolated. So if you've been able to write the manifold as the quotient by a finite group, but it should preserve this structure of a holomorphic form, if you've been able to write it globally in that form, then you should expect string propagation to make sense. Here we have a case where, well, it's a complex, it's a real eight-manifold, orbifold, right, because of the Z2 action, and so string propagation should make perfect sense on it. Okay, so now there's this little debate about whether that's a relevant example or not, because after all, string theory is 10-dimensional, and we're compactifying down to 2 dimensions, and the physics in 2 dimensions is rather more complicated than in the other compactification cases. So one can argue a little bit about whether we should care about that. In fact, there are other very close cousins of this example which live in slightly higher dimension than that, which are important to consider, and which indicate that, you know, giving a good definition of what Calabi-Yau singularity is not a trivial matter, I guess is the way I would like to say it. However, this problem of the ambiguity doesn't really show up until I get to Calabi-Yau fourfolds, and most of what I'll be talking about today is Calabi-Yau twofolds and threefolds, and so I can ignore it for a little while, but ultimately it can't be ignored.
What is the simplest threefold singularity which is rigid?
Simplest threefold singularity which is rigid is C3 mod Z3, the one I wrote down. I don't know.
No, rigid in a killer sense as well. No blow-ups, no different reasons.
I'm not aware of one.
As far as I know, the commutative algebra
for abelian
interpretation.
Right, I'm not interested. Non-abelian.
No, but as far as I know, every single Calabi-Yau singularity that you have been able to write down emits blow-ups.
Well, again, there's a question of what there's a question of what the definition is going to be of Calabi-Yau singularity, and so if I adopt the definition which is kind of motivated from the work in algebraic geometry from the 1980s,
yes.
Then every such singularity has blow-ups, which are Calabi-Yau, but in dimension 4 and beyond, that's not true, and that's the first example. So for a second class of examples, maybe I want to take something like this. I'll take a hypersurface, which generalizes that first case that I had a minute ago.
So
yeah.
We had the second example in dimension 4, which has neither deformation nor
not off the top of my head. Surely there is one. Let's see. No, I think I can give a whole family of quotient singularity examples, in fact.
In dimension four,
yeah. I mean, I do know that all of the singularities of this form, where you act by the root of unity, its inverse, and then some other eigenvalue and its inverse, where A and K are relatively prime. So that's an isolated singularity. And I'm pretty sure that the same argument which shows that it has no blow-up would work for this class of families, for this class of singularities. The argument comes in two steps. First, you check that there's no, you check pretty easily that there's no toric resolution of singularities, and then you invoke a theorem of Jonathan Fine, which tells you that if you had a Calabi-Yau resolution of this kind, that it would have to be isomorphic in codimension one to a toric blow-up. In codimension one, that you show that it doesn't have a toric blow-up. Yeah, it would have to be isomorphic to a toric blow-up. Because it's isomorphic in codimension one to a toric blow-up, it has to be isomorphic to a toric blow-up. That's the way the theorem goes. So here I want to, instead of generalize quotients, I'll generalize hypersurfaces. So I look at a simple equation. These obviously are going to have deformations. I'll look at a simple equation like that. And, it's a little hard to motivate why we would say this, but the natural Calabi-Yau condition in this context is k less than or equal to n minus 1. Okay? So if I'm working with C3, that's surfaces, then k would be at most rats, k less than or equal to n. K would be at most 2. If I'm working with, so that defines a surface. And if I'm working with C4, then k is at most 3. I have two cases to consider there. I have a quadratic singularity and a cubic singularity. Yeah, so now I'm going to mention what the algebraic geometer's condition on the singularity is. So the algebraic geometer's condition on the singular point, so I had some, let me just describe it for an isolated singularity to make my life slightly simpler. I have some singular point y, and I look at any possible blow-up x, which gives me a non-singular manifold. So thanks to a really hard theorem proved by Hironaka in the early 1960s, we know that there are ways of blowing up singularities. So my statement over here that there was no blow-up, it was no blow-up with the additional condition of having a nowhere vanishing holomorphic four-form, but there always is a blow-up. So what do I get from the blow-up? Well, the inverse image of P is some set called the exceptional set here, and the Calabi-Yau condition, the first part of the Calabi-Yau condition that I'm imposing is that there is an omega y, which is a holomorphic n-form on y, on the smooth part of y, with no zeros. And the thing which I have to ask is, what happens to pi inverse of omega y? And the Calabi-Yau condition is that pi inverse of omega y is holomorphic. So a priori, because it was only defined away from the singular point, it might have had zeros or poles or whatever along the exceptional set. And in fact, if you blow up extra, so if you you can blow up a smooth point as well as a singular point, if you blow up a smooth point, you'll get extra zeros for any holomorphic form introduced by that blow up. So this turns out to be a very reasonable condition, the condition that this is holomorphic on one or equivalently on any smooth blow-up x. Now, So that definition was formulated before people started studying Calabi-Yau manifolds. That's the definition of a canonical singularity, roughly, in this context. In the Gorenstein context, I should say, for people who know what the definitions are. And the point is that that blow-up may be a little more than you wanted. So you can kind of ask, is there a sufficiently small blow-up that holomorphic form would have no zeros? That's what fails in dimension 4, but in dimension 3 it works. So it's known it's a theorem that all such Calabi-Yau singularities in dimension less than or equal to 3. Oh, hang on. I'm about to say something wrong, so let me not say it. Right. So you can ask whether it's got a smooth blow-up or not, and in these two cases, so in my examples, they have smooth blow-ups. So the x1 cubed up through x4 cubed equals 0 case, it has a smooth blow-up, which looks like the total space of a line bundle over a cubic surface in CP3. So these four coordinates were thought of as coordinates in C4. The blowing up operation replaces the origin in C4 with a copy of CP3, and within that CP3, the equation naturally defines a cubic hypersurface in CP3. So the total space of the blow up turns out to be a line bundle over that cubic hypersurface, and this is a case where it's Calabi-Yau in the sense that pi upper star omega y has no zeros on that blow up. If you try to do that for the x1 squared plus x4 squared equals 0 term, then you get the total space of a line bundle over a quadric surface, degree 2 hypersurface, and pi upper star omega y vanishes all along that quadric surface. So there are subtleties about doing the blow-ups in that case. And it turns out that there is a trick for this particular example, which is to rewrite a sum of four squares in an interesting form. So I'll rewrite it as x1 plus ix2, x1 minus ix2, and then x3 plus ix4, x3 minus ix4. So here the blow-up I did was called blowing up the origin. I haven't written down what that means, but many of you have seen it before. Here, if I instead blow up a strange-looking thing, which is the ideal generated by x1 plus ix2 and x3 plus ix4, then the inverse image of the point is actually CP1. It's not two-dimensional, it's one-dimensional. And the total space, or the blow-up, is the total space of a rank 2 vector bundle, which is known as OCP1 of minus 1, direct sum OCP1 of minus 1. And for this one, for this pi upper star omega y, has no zeros. So blowing up is a little bit tricky, and in particular, blowing up only so much that we won't get any zeros of the holomorphic form that we want, that we didn't want, is definitely a little bit tricky. Let me just point out one slight generalization of this example. So if I simply take x1 squared plus x2 squared plus x3 squared plus x4 to the k equals 0, then this has a Calabi-Yau blowup if k is even. And you get it exactly the same way I did over here, because then I can factor this term, right? This pair is no trouble factoring. This is really a sum of squares, or difference of squares if I put in the I. And I can do the same kind of factoring, but it has no Calabi-Yau blowup if k is odd.
Is that a theorem?
That's a theorem. That's a theorem. It even has an attribution. Okay, so part of the point of the examples is to... Pardon?
Deformations don't feel by parity of k in some sense.
That's correct. It always has deformations.
Here is according to AK in the diagram.
That's correct.
So it's interesting that...
That's right. Well, it's a bouquet of spheres, but of course they're three spheres, right? I mean, yeah. Okay, so this was not a case where my examples were meant to lead you to a clean picture. This was a case where simple examples were intended to leave you with the impression that there is more work to be done before we understand what's going on. And that impression, that's not sort of deliberately trying to mislead you in that direction. That's the case.
So what is the mirror of this phenomenon?
Well, you'll notice that's a non-compact guy, and so people write down mirrors of non-compact spaces, but those mirrors tend to be Landau-Ginzburg type theories, and it's a little hard to directly interpret as a Calabi-Yau what it means. So you can ask for examples where this has a Calabi-Yau mirror, and I don't know an example where I can find this point close enough to a large complex structure limit point that I can give a geometric interpretation to the Calabi-Yau mirror. That doesn't mean there isn't such an example, but I don't happen to know one.
Well, in the case of k equals 2, you do
that,
right?
Sorry, I can find examples of that for even. I thought you were asking about odd, right?
Yeah, I was asking about this phenomenon, but you say that for k greater than 2, that's where...
By the way, even for k equal 2, it's not so easy to find those singularities that are really close to large complex structure limit. There are some serious issues with respect to relating the global and local interpretations of this kind of small blow-up of Calabi-Yau singularities. I'll be happy to discuss those at some point. Okay, so I want to kind of go back to my general setup and sort of explain what the limits are in these parameter spaces that I'd like to take, and then how you kind of identify which limits you want to think of as being Calabi-Yau singularities. Let's see. It's already 20 minutes to 5. I advertised this as a series of lectures, so I'll get so far today and then I'll continue later. I'm not sure how far I'll get today. So the part of the parameter space which sounds like it should be the easiest part, at least to an algebraic geometer, is the part having to do with complex structures. So if I'm looking at the space of complex structures on one of these manifolds, well, I mentioned this fact that when n is at least 3, what happens when n is at least 3 is that the you can read off the space of holomorphic p-forms on a manifold with holonomy SUN and discover that the only holomorphic p-forms are the case where p equals n. So the space of holomorphic two forms on this Calabi-Yau manifold has to vanish when n is at least 3. And so that implies that all of H2 of x with real coefficients is of type 1-1. And so there aren't any real constraints about where the Kähler classes might go in this space. So
don't you require simply corrective and stuff like that?
Like T2 cross.
I said holonomy equal to SUN, not contained in SUN. In particular, I can take the intersection. Well, I can take integral classes in here, so I can find lots of classes lambda with the property that lambda squared is positive, and maybe lambda dot the class of C is positive for all holomorphic curves C sitting on the manifold X. Well, that looks like an infinite number of conditions, but it turns out to describe a finite cone. It's, in fact, the integral points within the Kähler cone. And in such a situation, for appropriate large values of n, n lambda corresponds to an ample line bundle, very ample line bundle, I should say, on the space X. And, well, up through, maybe I should allow rational classes so that I can talk about density, but anyway, the set of directions of such classes is definitely dense in the projectivization of H2, and so there are lots of possible ways of embedding such X's into projective space. So very ample line bundle means that there's a corresponding embedding of X into some projective space CPM. And if I fix such an embedding, then I can make an approximation to the space of complex structures by looking at the set of all Zs, which are subschemes, excuse me for the language, subschemes of CPM, such that the Hilbert polynomial of Z is equal to the Hilbert polynomial of X, or I should say, maybe this embedding is called alpha, Hilbert polynomial of the image alpha of X, and I can mod that out by the automorphisms of CPM, okay? And I get a space which looks like a parameter space for all the Calabi-Yaus of this type. Well, that's a space which, so there are technical complications. So the first point is that I have to take what's called GIT quotient, a quotient from geometric invariant theory. It may be that this group action doesn't have by itself nice algebraic properties, and that you have to remove some sub-variety of the variety of all schemes with this Hilbert polynomial before you take the quotient. That's sort of point number one. Point number two is that for some bundles, not every nearby Calabi-Yau in the complex moduli space will have that bundle. And so I might have missed some Calabi-Yaus by taking this this parameter space, but there is kind of a way around that, which is to sort of take the union over all possible n's and lambdas of the corresponding MN lambda. I guess I should call this MN lambda. And, well, maybe it's not finite type, but that looks like a, that has as a subset, an open subset, some kind of quasi-projective variety. Which is the space of all Calabi-Yaus of this type. Okay, so that was a sort of two-minute summary of some hard work that one does in algebraic geometry to try to construct explicitly a parameter space for all these Calabi-Yau manifolds. We're used to working with a very simple collection of examples. The simple collection of examples is given by complete intersections in toric varieties. Complete intersections in toric varieties have the nice property that you can write down equations very explicitly for those complete intersections. And you avoid the complication which I mentioned in that example of C3 mod Z3 of having to worry about relations among the equations and relations among the relations and so on and so forth. In that simple case of complete intersections and toric varieties, it's extremely easy to write down all that algebraic data. For general embeddings of general Calabi-Yau manifolds, it's quite hard to write down all that algebraic data. But this method, which goes back to, it really has its origins in the 19th century, but it was systematized in the study of moduli problems by David Mumford in the 1960s, where you fix the Hilbert polynomial and take all the subschemes with that Hilbert polynomial. That will include all the Calabi-Yaus we want, together with some singular limits, right, which is provided to us by a set of possible subschemes in CPM. So as a crude approximation, these are the limits of complex structures which we might want to take, but they can include things much worse than we really want to call Calabi-Yau manifolds. Yes. So let me talk about the case of K3 surfaces, which is very slightly different than the case I've just discussed. So that's the case where n equals 2. So in the case of K3 surfaces, I can avoid a lot of problems by restrict the complex structures to all those with the H11 x intersect H2x integer containing a fixed L. So this is going to be some fixed lattice of signature 1 comma rho minus 1. So I get a whole bunch of examples using different possible values of L. So I restrict the complex structures to those, and I restrict the Kähler metrics that I care about essentially to L tensor R. So I'm not studying the space of all Calabi-Yau metrics or all Calabi-Yau structures in this case. I'm only studying the limited ones. But they now have the advantage that I can repeat this discussion. I can construct an algebraic geometer's moduli space by choosing my lambdas from L and my appropriate n's to get very ample classes. And then I can build these moduli spaces. And in this case, there's actually this problem of a possible infinite set of moduli spaces doesn't occur. And I get some kind of description of these spaces in terms of a symmetric space O of L perp tensor R mod the compact and then mod some arithmetic subgroup. And then you take a compactification of that, which people who study locally symmetric spaces know how to construct very well. So there's some nice construction of the entire parameter space, which essentially is using the periods of the holomorphic 2 form. And those periods are under sufficient control in this case that we can do the construction of the moduli space. So what does that moduli space look like? That moduli space mostly has K3 surfaces in it. But then it has boundary divisors where the K3 surface breaks up into a pair of components meeting along an elliptic curve. And then it has points on those boundary divisors where, could have mentioned two loci on those boundary divisors, where you get components that meet in cycles of rational curves. And then you have loci out here where you have ADE type singularities on the K3s. So it's actually only the ADE singularities on the K3s that one wants to consider to be singular K3s in this sense. These degeneration limits are sort of too severe. The K3 has broken up too much. If I can just give a simple example, if I take a quartic, if I take the space of all quartics in CP3, that's an example of this. Well, I could let it just get an ordinary double point. I could let it have one of these x1 squared plus x2 squared up through x4 squared points. That's one of these A1 singularities that's part of the ADE classification. That would be the simplest kind. But I could also take a quartic which was quadric plus quadric. And as you may know, the intersection of two degree two hypersurfaces, two quadrics in CP3, is an elliptic curve. That's what I'm talking about here. Or I could take plane plus plane plus plane plus plane. That's a tetrahedron. And the intersection of one of those planes with the other three gives a triangle in each case. So I get these intersections along cycles of rational curves. So these guys are kind of too degenerate to be considered limits of Calabi-Yau's. In the K3 case, there's a really pretty characterization of which limits we want to take by considering the monodromy on the cohomology as you take a loop that surrounds one of the boundary components. So in these cases, you get finite monodromy. And in these cases, you get two different kinds of infinite monodromy. So this is infinite monodromy of two different kinds. And those kinds characterize the kind of geometric degeneration that you find in those spaces. Well, that detailed level of information actually requires more control over the periods of the holomorphic n form than is available when n is bigger than 2. So I can do it in that very detailed form for K3 cases. I can't quite do it in the other cases, but I can at least speculate that things such as finite monodromy when I go around the singularities is a reasonable condition to have. And I certainly don't want to allow the entire space to break up into several components. I then lose track of what I thought I meant by Calabi-Yau. In physics, by the way, people understand what these limits mean. This is the so-called large complex structure limit, which is, well, anyway, it's a so-called large complex structure limit. This is some kind of intermediate step. That elliptic curve plays some interesting role in certain kinds of degenerations, and that's itself the subject of a different lecture, which I think I won't try to give today. But there is something to be said there. Okay. So I can go through this big machine. I can build complex structures globally. It doesn't really answer the question of which complex structures I expect to see locally, but it at least motivates, helps to motivate the definition that people use. Question or stretching? You have a question.
In the Mumford GIT description of the Hilbert scheme, there's no metric data, so does that appear when you're restricting?
Well, the metric data is implicit in the choice of lambda. And so I have different choices of lambda, which are why I get different compactifications and, to some extent, slightly different collections of Calabi-Yau's included in each moduli space, because a given choice of Kähler data can sort of miss a couple of Calabi-Yau's. I didn't let you finish your question, but maybe I answered it.
Okay, so, but you can still describe the line bundles entirely algebraically without period integrals.
Sure.
And so is it just the equivalent? I guess going between the GIT description and...
So here I could do a similar thing, right? I could make a map from M and lambda into some period space by calculating period integrals. Okay. In this case, there's something called the Griffiths transversality relation for periods, which is a complicated set of partial differential equations which have to be satisfied by the image of this map. In the K3 case, the Griffiths transversality relations are trivial, and therefore I get a surjective, well, sorry, it's easy to show that I get a locally surjective map. It was a hard thing, people worked all through the 70s to show that you get a globally surjective map. But I can sort of use those periods to get a good handle on the structure of the moduli space. So I could construct it using GIT, but I get a lot more, I sort of have a quicker path to information about it if I use periods. Yeah, historically, actually, there are some technical difficulties in constructing it in, for any value of the dimension using GIT, which hadn't been solved when people got their hands on the periods for K3s. So in the early 80s, there were explicit constructions of GIT compactifications for K3 surfaces of low degree, like the Korda case, where people figured out which things got left in and which got left out. I mentioned in the GIT quotient, I had to leave some things out. People being giant shot, one particular person figured out what got left in and what got left out. And that was kind of a prelude to some work probably 10 years later in which GIT was shown to work in general in the Calabi-Yau case. Well, so let me do a similar kind of overview for Kähler structures. So in the application to physics, one does something that's a little unusual, which is that the Kähler class is to be complexified. And the natural space to look at for this parameter is the set of objects alpha in H2 with complex coefficients, but actually you mod out by the integral coefficients, such that the imaginary part of alpha is Kähler. So that takes into account this complexification, which is adding an additional class in H2. That additional class in for the physical application one wants to take to be only well-defined up to integral shifts. And this is a way of putting them together. And then, actually, I should mod out the resulting space by the automorphisms of X. So this is the a natural complex space which ought to parameterize the choice of Kähler classes together with their partner called the B field, the other two form, which is supposed to be playing a role in the story. Now, a space like this, this is a so-called tube domain. And the quotient is well-behaved. Conjecturally. So I'll try to explain that in a couple of minutes. The problem is that we don't know, well, there's a specific conjecture about the action of the automorphisms of X on the Kähler cone, which is needed to know that the quotient is well behaved. It seems quite reasonable from the point of view of physics that the quotient ought to be well behaved since it's defining these physical parameters, but only special cases of that conjecture are known. So I want to describe the set of Kähler classes and I can describe the set of Kähler classes well when n, which is the dimension of x, is 2 or 3, but much less detailed information is available at the moment when n is bigger than strictly bigger than 3. Right, so this is a moment to mention mirror symmetry. So mirror symmetry is a prediction from the physics that there should be, for many Calabi-Yau manifolds, a mirror partner in which the roles of the moduli space of complex structures, so in the notation I was just using, moduli space of complex structures for the mirror partner should somehow agree with the moduli space of Kähler structures on the original guy, but it's also known that this is definitely only true locally, and that certain directions in this space, namely the directions where m alpha goes to infinity, correspond to certain limit points in this space, which are called large complex structure limit points. But in the application in which mirror symmetry is most visible, which is the compactification of the type 2 string theories, it's understood that the geometric description of the Kähler parameters receives some kind of quantum corrections, so-called, in this physical theory, whereas the complex structure parameter space does not receive quantum corrections. And so because of the difficulty of understanding what the quantum corrections are, you only expect a kind of local isomorphism here. In fact, many of the things which we now feel we understand about the Kähler moduli space arise from identifying locally the Kähler moduli space with an appropriate large complex structure limit, complex structure moduli space of a mirror partner, and then investigating that and trying to reinterpret what you get in terms of the original guy. But let me just talk mathematically about what we know about the Kähler classes. So I'm going to work inside H2XR, and script K is going to represent the script K of X is going to represent the set of possible Kähler classes of X. We know that script K of X is contained in the set of alpha such that alpha, dimension X equals n for a minute, such that alpha to the n is positive. That's one of the conditions. That alpha to the n means the integrated class, right? That's one of the conditions that you need in order to be Kähler. And, of course, it also is contained further in the set of alpha such that alpha to the n is positive, and alpha restricted to C is positive. Well, it has positive integral, so maybe I should say the integral over C of alpha is positive for all holomorphic curves C in the space X. That's just an easy consequence of the Kähler condition, that it has to induce a Kähler metric on that holomorphic curve, and that Kähler metric has to have non-zero area on the holomorphic curve. These conditions numerically are enough to determine the curve. So there's something called Kleiman's criterion for ampleness. Which tells you that these conditions are enough. But what's hard is to get your hands on what are all the possible holomorphic curves on X. If you knew all the holomorphic curves on X, you'd be able to write down this cone right away, and vice versa. If you were able to write down the cone, you would know all the holomorphic curves on X. So Kleiman's criterion says that the that K of X is the interior of the set where alpha n is bigger than 0, and these integrals are greater than or equal to 0. It's the interior of that set. So I weakened the condition slightly, and then I took the interior, and I got precisely the Kähler cone. In the cases of dimensions 2 and 3, we know a little bit more. So if n is less than or equal to 3, we know that, in fact, K of X is locally polyhedral. Polyhedral away from the set of alphas such that alpha to the n equals 0. It's K of X bar, the closure. It's locally polyhedral away from there. And if n is equal to 2, it's actually just locally polyhedral. So what can happen is the following. I could have a case of, say, a surface where there were lines of irrational slope which were the boundaries of the Kähler cone, and then the Kähler cone sort of had in it all of the rational approximations to this line of irrational slope. So the Kähler cone would do something like this. Sorry, I've taken a slice of the Kähler cone. So this is maybe, it should all be a cone over this guy. Right. So you could take the rational approximations to these irrational lines, and you would have a ray on the edge of the Kähler cone, which corresponds to one of those the edges correspond to the curves C. You have those edges for all of these segments that join consecutive rational approximations to that irrational number. So it can be a little bit complicated because of phenomena like that. It's a cone, so the interior of the cone is supposed to be like this, but that's a convex shape as I've described it here. And it's conceivable that it might have some part of its boundary along the locus where alpha cubed equals 0 in the case n equals 3. It's actually there are no examples known of that, but it's not been proved that that can't happen. Okay, so there's a rough classification of limits in this case. Right, I have some cone, might not be quite finite, but now I'm moving about in the cone. Of course, I've got to also consider my the real part of alpha as part of this, but let me just talk about the imaginary part of alpha. The times I start to get out of the cone are when the imaginary part of alpha approaches one of these walls. Or in this curve case, it might approach the curve part of the boundary, and I have nothing to say about that. So if it's approaching one of these walls, what that means is that in the limit, so alpha limit, the integral over C of this limiting value is equal to 0. Or in other words, the limiting area, limit as alpha goes to the limiting value, of the area of C under these Kähler metrics is equal to 0. And so what we should expect to see is those C's, precisely the C's which belong to that cohomology class, belong to this wall, are shrinking down to 0 size. So in the case of n equal 2, that's exactly what happens. You have a C shrinking down to a point. It turns out that the C has to be a CP1. And the only things which are happening generically along these loci are single rational curves shrinking to points. But of course, these single rational curves might form kind of diagrams. And in higher codimension, you could imagine that several of the rational curves were shrinking down. So in higher codimension, multiple rational curves can shrink. The fact that that set of curves has to fit inside of a lattice of the appropriate signature, leaving over, by the way, on the complement, something of signature 1, comma k, tells you, ends up telling you combinatorially that you get an ADE type graph. It's a pretty easy combinatorial argument that you get an ADE type graph characterizing all the singularities. So actually, I meant to point this out when I was doing quotients. If you do quotient singularities in dimension 2, you get, and you insist that the holomorphic 2 form be preserved, you get this ADE list. If you do this kind of Kähler limit in dimension 2, you also get the ADE list. That's the list in dimension 2. There's no ambiguity about what the Calabi-Yau singularities are. The physics of this in dimension 2 is that there is a... So the type 2A string theory gets a non-abelian gauge symmetry in this limit of the corresponding group, corresponding to the ADE group. So anyway, I thought I was going to spend 20 minutes on that point because I thought I would be at this point a lot earlier, but I'm not doing that today. In the case of dimension 3, let me just quickly say that there are basically three possible behaviors for these walls. Well, four possible behaviors. So zero is that every x in x belongs to some cx with cx with the integral that's a C little x, in the limiting value equal to 0. So that's the case where x collapses to something of lower dimension. And that's not a case where we're really seeing a singularity appear. That's a case where we're seeing an analog of these more drastic degenerations that I mentioned in the complex structure case. The cases relevant to Calabi-Yau singularities are three types. One type is that a finite set of curves collapses, and that's to points. And again, I'm only doing the codimension 1 case, so it's just like this single CP1 case. I can have a one parameter family of curves collapse to a curve, or I can have a multi-parameter family of curves all in a surface S collapse to a point. So let me point out that these are the inverses of blow-ups, and I gave examples of all three kinds of blow-ups in the early part of the lecture. So C3 mod Z3 is exactly a case like this, where I got a CP2, that's the surface S, which is collapsing to a point. And this is the kind of inverse of the blow-up of the C3 mod Z3. That was also the case for X1 cubed up to X4 cubed equals 0. Both of those examples gave me surfaces in the blow-up. Here, I could take C2 mod Z2 cross C. So I didn't actually do that explicitly before, but I could take a one-parameter family of the same phenomenon that I had in dimension 2. That gives me a family of curves collapsing to a curve. And here, my factored case, x1 plus ix2 equals x3 plus ix4 equals 0, that blow-up gave me a CP1 as the inverse image of a single point. That's an example of this particular kind. So it's actually much easier to get your hands on Calabi-Yau singularities from this Kähler point of view than it is from the complex structure point of view. And in subsequent lectures, I want to describe things like the remarks Sergei made about the deformations of the Calabi-Yau singularities. There's something to be said there that's pretty interesting. And go into a lot more detail about how to analyze them from this kind of blow-down point of view, from the Kähler limit point of view. All right, that'll do it for today. Any questions? Any more questions, I should say. A complete classification? Well, there's not like this nice ADE one, I would say. So what there is a classification of what blow-ups you do and what happens when you do them, but there isn't the sort of combinatorial step of exactly in which ways you could put all those things together. So there's kind of an inductive way to describe what they all are, but there's not a classification per se.
Okay, thanks again.
Sure.